Welcome to the Human and Technology Podcast. This podcast is for anyone who develops, distributes, or uses technology. For all those who always have the feeling that technology overwhelms or dominates them. For everyone who wants to know how to deal with technology in everyday life. For anyone who wants to understand what technology does to us and how we can get our lives back. This podcast is for those who want to make technology sexy. All the product developers, designers, UX, UI professionals, product managers, CTOs, and CEOs. And it is for you. My name is Dr. Peter Ryska. My friends call me Dr. Peter. I am your host, and I am happy that you are here. I have thought quite a while about making an episode about the development process of an HMI solution, of HMIs in general. First of all, it is a comparably complex issue, and it requires quite some focus, particularly if it is an audio-only podcast, as I have it here. And then I was not really sure whether a podcast about an HMI development process will find a target audience here amongst my listeners. But I received a few signals that this topic is interesting for the people listening to me. So I decided to make a little series of episodes around the creation of an HMI, about the development process, about what is required to come from an idea that you might have to a product that you can sell and that you can that can make users happy and that make the lives of people better. And for this, we need a certain process. We need to consider a couple of things. And well, this is the first podcast episode about how to do this. And it very much focuses on the first part of the development process, which is the analysis part. So between having an idea and creating a product, having a ready product, from an HMI point of view, I see three steps involved in that. First one is analysis, finding out where am I, who are my users, what is my target, where will I end up. All these things in the beginning. Then in the middle, the biggest slice, the biggest piece is the creation process, creating the HMI. And then we have the implementation phase where things will get into reality and become into software, into hardware, into graphics, and all that is then turned into a final product. And the entire process, the entire all of these three steps are underlined by a constant flow, a constant row of user feedback activities. So this may include usability analysis, expert analysis, but also usability tests, larger usability studies, focus groups, and so on. But the creation, the implementation, the usability part will at least be each and a separate episode. In the beginning, we focus on the beginning, which is the analysis part. And with these three steps, I am not alone. I am basing that one on the usability engineering life cycle of Deborah Mayhew. She invented that almost 20 years ago. I think it was in 1999 when it was published. And she's defining three steps as well in a development process. And they pretty much they're pretty much the same as the steps that I use and that I have defined for my process. So she talks about requirements analysis, then the testing, design and development phase, and then the installation phase. So in the beginning, what she calls requirement analysis is my analysis phase. Her design testing development is pretty much my creation. And then we have a little difference in where the handover or the end of the core HMI development process is. She puts it a little later than I do. I make the handover between the creation phase and the implementation phase. So Deborah Mayhew differs between development on one side, which she puts in the middle step, and the installation, including all the user feedbacks and the maintenance activities, into the third step. But just to let you know, yes, it's my process that I'm having here, but I'm not the only one that has a process containing three steps. And it seems like what I apply is not too bad. I'm not alone with this. So let's start with the analysis. What do you do in an analysis? What do you do at the very initial steps? What do I do when I show up at my clients and when we kick off a new HMI development process together? The first question that needs to be clarified, what kind of product do we have? Do we talk about a smartphone app? Do we talk about a car navigation? Do we talk about an aircraft cockpit? Do we talk about some studio electronics, effect racks? You may talk about, all these things are different products. They all have different requirements, different contexts of use. They all have different users. And the sort of first thing is, what is it we're talking about? The second one connected with this is the user group. Who is using this product? And to my surprise, when I start working with my clients, they very often do not know who are my users. Who at the very end of the day is taking my product into his or her hands and then trying to achieve a goal with this, trying to reach a target with that particular technology. Do we have younger users? Do we have older users? Do we have educated, non-educated? Where on the globe are they? What are their experiences? What are their wishes, their dreams? What are their needs? What do we need to fulfill? What kind of requirements are there in this certain user group? And is it a very narrow user group? Is it just one kind of humans that we have there? Or is it a broader group? Do we have a high diversity in the group of users of my product? And so again, this is a clarification that needs to be done before we start thinking about technology or anything else. Closely connected to the user group is the question, how can we create value? So technology in itself is has no value, is not even good or bad. It is neutral. But with the value that we create with technology, that is what it makes valuable. That is what it makes desirable. That's what it makes useful. So with any technology we have, we shall fulfill needs of our users, wishes of our users, fulfilling dreams and making people's lives better. And better by the means of safer, faster, funnier, more focused, more cleaned up. I mean, all those things are making people's lives better, and a technology has to fulfill any of these to create some value and to be positive, to be good technology. And then I get into discussing features. So what shall this product do? And this is like dancing on the razor's edge. Because, I mean, the less features we have, the less complexity we have, the easier the product gets, the more focused the product gets, the easier the HMI is. So we simply have less features and less complexity and less layers and less menu tree. And everything is pretty straight and down to earth if we reduce the number of features. And of course, with the zero features, you have zero functionality, as you have zero HMI, and you have zero value. So again, it is not in yes, no, it's not a black and white thing, but it is a pretty delicate compromise that you need to do. And there are parties at my clients that tend to say, okay, lower number of features, particularly if there is a person being aware about the complexity of HMIs and what that does to users. On the other hand, there are managers, top managers, their marketing people, salespeople, and they all love features. They all love, hey, we can do this, and we added that, and this one is new in here. And I mean, many of them are more like advocates of the clients and saying, hey, my clients wants, and we need to have. And if you have a closer look, I mean, this might be one single person at one single client of the company. So it's one single user of a product, and this person may be very dominant and very communicative and saying, I need this feature, I need this feature. And then companies tend to put this one in, and I mean, they have one person that really loves it and all the rest is just confused by it. One of my old friends of the HMI arena is working at a big German car OEM, at a big German car maker, and he's leading the HMI activities there. And he said to me, I questioned every single feature we have on our dashboards. I questioned everyone. If there was no one really explaining me where the value is, where the benefit is, why we really need this feature, I just killed it. And I think this approach is unique, but this approach is good. It is required to reduce the complexity of technology down to where it makes really sense and where it makes fun to use it. So the feature discussion, always a big thing at my clients. Another discussion is about the user groups, and particularly about the mix between professionals and amateurs, when educated and non-educated humans working with the HMI or dealing with the HMI. So it makes a big difference if you have a professional user. He or she will make money by using this HMI. He or she is very well trained, maybe very well selected. And so we can think about a certain level of education, a certain level of knowledge these people bring in. And on the other side, there are the, I call them amateurs or ordinary Janes and Joes, more or less everybody that we have. So Let's have a look at two very clear examples of that. On the professional side, there are pilots, aircraft pilots. And if you want to become a pilot, that's not easy. I mean, they do a lot of pre-selection. And 30, 35 years ago, I personally thought about becoming a pilot. And I found out, okay, I'm short-sighted, so they will simply not take me. And it's not only that, it's also you have to deal with three-dimensional tasks. You know, have to know a lot about physics, about mathematics. You have to be a pretty technical thinker, and that's only the pre-selection. And then they educate you over years and years and years, and then you become a professional pilot, and you fly aircrafts, and then you have to fly these aircrafts to not lose your license. So if you want to keep your pilot's license, you have to prove that you're flying so and so many hours per, I don't know, month or year, to keep it alive. And then on a pretty constant rhythm, you go to flight simulators and you get some extra training on critical situations. They throw you into critical situations and you have to solve them. So you have to prove that you're fit, that you're able to solve this. On the other side, there are car drivers. So depending on where on the globe you live, between 16, 17, 18, maybe 19, 20, you make your driving license. And they take everyone. And they are almost everyone, not really everyone, but almost everyone is allowed to make a driving license. And then you get a few weeks of training, and then you get your license, and then you're fine. Then you're done. And many people I know, they make their driving license at the age of 18, and then they go to university. They don't have the money to buy a car. They drive every now and then here and there. And then, and I don't know, 23, 22, and then early mid-20s, they may get their first car. And then they start driving. And many of these people just go back to zero and they start learning again. But there's no trainer anymore. There's no teacher anymore. So they learn it just by doing. And even if you do not drive for 20, 25, 30 years, you just can get a car. Once you got a license, you can get a car. You can get into the car and you can just start driving. And as I said, they take almost everyone. Old people, young people, people being aware about all the technology that they drive around with, people that are not. So it's a totally different user group. And if you want to design a human-machine interface, if you want to make this technology efficiently controllable, then you will need to know who is my target audience, who will use the product, what level of training will this person have, how much will it be selected? I mean, what is the ground people stand on when they use the technology I design an HMI for? Another point is the cultural background. And I really love to talk about this one, although, I mean, it may be a trap. It's pretty dangerous to talk about cultural backgrounds because you build stereotypes and then you put people into boxes based on these stereotypes and say, okay, the Asians do, or the North Americans are, or the Germans typically are like. And then you put some words behind this, and you add some conditions there. And of course, you will find Chinese people that do not what you state that the Chinese do, and you will find Americans that are totally different from the typical American. And so it's always a bit dangerous to do this, but on the other hand, these stereotypes are not totally wrong. They help us to group users, user groups, to build user groups, to build them up, and then to adapt HMIs to, for example, technology experience, for example, personal or cultural tastes, the meaning of colors, the meaning of icons, all that differs around the globe. And so it makes sense to differentiate between user groups on different parts of the globe. And I will definitely do a separate episode on cultural backgrounds one day, because I find this totally fascinating. And the big discussion point is, what is the role of companies like Google or Apple or Microsoft that do some unification of the global taste, and what will remain once we all know how to use a Google smartphone, an Android smartphone, or an Apple smartphone, whatever. But cultural background plays a role, and it may even get political, may even go beyond taste and personal experiences. But as I said, I will put up a separate episode on this one, and give you my thoughts on the cross-cultural usability, cross-cultural HMI design. Another important product another point when you design a product is the history of a product. Usually there is already something existing. When I come to go to a company, I have a client there and I say, yes, we have something here. And this is our today's product and it is successful. We want to improve it. We want to bring it to the next level. In my professional life, I had the situation only once to have a blank sheet of paper to design on, to have a totally open field to work in. That was when I was with a software startup called CAA. We were acquired by Harman Automotive, or Harman Becker at that time. And the then-time CEO of Harman Becker showed up, and he said to me, hey, Peter, I acquired CAA because you built the best HMI department of the entire automotive industry. And I mean, that was a wow moment in my life, and I love to talk about this until today. But the thing is, he said, we have our brand new car radio here, the brand new Becker car radio, and I want you to design the best possible HMI. So the functionality was basically set, and they had a very dedicated user group of Becker car radios at that time. But there was the feeling that they needed to have a restart in the entire HMI. And so I got the chance to design something from scratch on a blank sheet of paper. But as I said, usually this is not the case. When I show up at the client, they have a font, the company, a corporate font. They have company or corporate colors that they use. They have a product that is on the market, and they may had many, many hours of training they gave to their users. So they're used to a couple of HMI features or a couple of processes and principles behind that. And usually they say, we're going to keep this. And this has the advantage that there is guideline there, that there are some rails there that you can keep on, that you can hang on to. But on the other side, this we have a product and we just want to have an improvement, that limits the amount of innovation that you may put into a product, into an HMI. And then finally, on these generic points that you need to think of, is the legal situation. There's quite some regulation out there concerning HMI. So a good friend of mine is leading the development department of a medical device company. And he says that medical device HMIs, they're highly limited. So almost every color has a certain meaning. So if you use red in the HMI of a medical device, it is always, always means danger, something is wrong, something is broken, this device needs immediate attention. So you're having this one, red is indicating that, and green is always indicating it's good, it's okay, I don't need any attention, everything is good here. And so all the most of the other colors, they all have a certain meaning in that context. And there is legislation on this, and you will not get a certificate, you will not get an approval to bring a medical device to the market where you use red just because it's a beautiful color, but without any meaning behind it. And another example from the automotive industry, there are the so-called telltales. Those are the icons that indicate, for example, the indicators, the headlights, the horn. So they all need to have a certain design. I mean, ISO 25-75 defines these. And for example, in Europe, there's a legislation that says if you want to bring a car to the market, you need to meet this ISO standard, and you need to use all the icons used there for the windscreen wipers, for the rear window heating, whatever it is, there is an icon for almost every function. And you need to use this. And if you don't use it, you will not be able to get your car into the dealerships. So those are the legal things that you need to take care of. And I'm not aware about every domain, I'm far away from that, but on the automotive area I have a pretty good overview, and this is quite a lot of legislation that you need to meet, quite a few ISO standards and other legislation that is out there. So take care about this, otherwise you won't get a device to the market. It will not be approved, it will not be legal to sell it. Okay, so far about, let's say, the generic points, the things I am talking about when I get to my clients, and the things that you need to do as a very first analysis, where you need to get in, where you need to collect information on. For the rest of the time, for the rest of the podcast, I will talk a bit about the methods, the more formal methods of analysis that you may apply in the early stages of a development. And the first one I would like to talk about is the task analysis. So you need to analyze the task of the user. And the users may have a main task, a focus task, and a couple of side tasks. You need to know about all this. You need to know about the priorities in the task. And you may do this by talking to the people working with the device. So, for example, if you have a pilot and then you talk to the pilot and says, yeah, my main task is flying the aircraft and I have to take this and this and this and that. You may talk to the bosses of the people working there and ask them. There may be process descriptions where tasks are described. Or you just go out and ask people on the street if you want to design a smartphone app that helps people finding the right mode of public transport. Yeah, you should go out and ask people that may have problems to this. So those are the things that you do in the very early stages of a project, that you analyze the task of your user. Then another point that you can do is, if you have an existing HMI, is an expert analysis. And you go into a product and you find out, okay, they want to improve this particular device. They want to bring it onto a level, new level of HMI quality. Then you run through this HMI and you make an expert analysis. And you can do this in a more or less free, casual, open way. And then what an expert does is that he or she is looking at the status quo and comparing that one to a mental optimum, to an optimum this expert has in his or her mind, and just comparing and saying, okay, I'm pretty safe here, and this doesn't work, and this shouldn't be in a different way. So this uses the knowledge of the expert to get a rating out of this. Little more formal methods are, for example, cognitive walkthroughs. These cognitive walkthroughs, that is a procedure where you say, okay, I am in situation A and I want to get with this technology and with this HMI to B, to point B, and I have to make these steps. For example, in a car navigation, I want to type in my home address, the address where I live. And then at every single step that you do, you ask yourself a couple of predefined questions. And then you rate, okay, question 1 and 3 are fulfilled, 2 and 4 partially or not at all. And so you get a very good overview of these processes. And you do not need any external people. You do not need any users. You all do this based on your knowledge as an expert. And then you walk cognitively through this product for the HMI and you get a rating. Big advantage of this one is that you can do this before HMI implementation if you have a specification, maybe a manual tree available. So you can do a pretty good cognitive walkthrough in very early stages of the development. Another expert analysis are heuristic evaluations. So heuristics are, let's say, rules of thumb that you can use and that you can apply. The best known and very useful ones are the ones of Nielsen. Jacob Nielsen is one of the big gurus of HMI design, of HMI development, of HMI analysis and ratings. So, and then he developed 10 heuristics and that you can apply. 10 rules of thumb, and you can go through that and says, yeah, fulfilled, partially fulfilled, not at all fulfilled. And so you get a pretty good picture where you are. A totally different, very good method, particularly if you want to develop an HMI that is in a domain you are not fully into. So my background is clearly automotive, so I think I know a lot about cars and drivers and the relationship between cars and drivers. But I had a project with a welding machine company, and they had a machine to weld plastic tubes. Before that, by the way, I had not been aware that you can weld plastic tubes. I thought they are glued. But anyway, they are producing these machines, and I had no idea what people are doing with these machines. And definitely no idea. And so I asked them, do you have a construction place? Do you have people really applying your machine? They said yes, and they sent me to a place, and I was there. And a contextual inquiry basically is that you watch the people working, that you ask them to tell you what they do, and that you ask questions all the times. And the idea is like you are the newbie, and the person, an experienced person working with a product, working with a technology, working with an HMI, explains you what he or she is doing right now and why he or she is doing that and why this is particularly difficult and why this one is extremely critical. And so all this is given to you, and all this is you collect all this data from these people working with this. And in that particular case, when I had the project with a plastic tube welding machine, I found out, okay, this machine is standing about 2 or 3 meters away from the person working with it. And it was a sunny day on a construction place. So I realized that any kind of, let's say, small or fractured HMI will never work in this context. I need to have a very bold, very straightforward, very simple solution on a screen design to allow these guys to work with this. And if you work in a lab, if you analyze that, you will never find out about things like this. And so at the end of the day, you collect tons of information in a contextual inquiry that will help you and really bring in the real users, the real users' view into the development. Another thing you can analyze are log files. What are people doing with the product, with the technology when they're alone? You can collect them in the background of an interaction and then use them for analysis. Little footnote, take care about data privacy. There may be problems connected to that. You cannot just do this. You need certain approval procedures for this. But it's a very good one to find out what are people really doing, what really are they struggling with when they work with a certain technology. You can try to get user diaries. You give these diaries more or less formalized to users. They can fill in what they do with the product, with the technology. Problem here is, in the beginning, they will be very motivated, but if you do this over weeks and months, the amount of information you can collect gets lower and lower, and at the end you just get very poor data quality because people just don't like to fill in user diaries. You can have user interviews, you can have focus groups, invite people and have them interviewed in various formats and to collect data out of that. You can analyze earlier models. So as I said, it's very, very seldom that you start from scratch, from a totally blank sheet of paper. There will be a product there. And if it's not an own product, you can take a competitor's product and analyze that. And particularly in professional environments, if you have a professional development tool, if you have a machine tool, if you have a cockpit, then there will be information available on how users react with this, how they like it or do not like it. And so you can have a look at that one. I already mentioned benchmarks. You can always look at competitors' products. You can always look at products that are in other domains. They may be seen as a benchmark. You can ask your client, or you can ask the people that want to develop it, what is the benchmark? You can even ask users and say, hey, what is the benchmark? What is the best possible product in this area? And what I find out when I start working with a client, they very often say, make it like Apple, make it like an iPhone, make it like an iPad. So it seems like in the idea of many people today, the Apple HMI is some kind of benchmark. I have my own thoughts about this, but it is there, it is out there, and the opinion that you can, I mean, I know exactly that benchmarks are a good thing to collect information. Then you can ask marketing service departments, call centers. So if you ask a call center professional, they all collect this data in call centers. And there is one particular feature where 70% of all calls target to. 70% of all calls are concerning one particular feature. Then you know there is seriously something wrong and you need to change that. The sales guys are a good source of information. Keep in mind, sales guys are more the advocates of their clients, so they are not really neutral, but they want to bring in their clients' views and their clients' needs and their clients' ideas into the project or into the product. And they're a good source, but filter what they say. And then there are very special methods of collecting user behavior, like eye movement collections, or physiological measurements. And there is a method called GOMS models, which slices interaction into the smallest possible pieces and puts a price tag by means of time, puts a time onto each single slice of interaction. That's extremely analytical, a very mathematical method, very useful in certain contexts, but very often totally overloaded. All right, so I talked about analysis, the analysis that you do before you start an HMI project, in the beginning of an HMI project, the first projects when you want to develop a human-machine interface and want to make it the best possible user fit. And in the first part, I talked about the more generic things like what kind of product is it, what user group do you have, what features will you have in it, how do you handle more features and more complexity versus less features and less complexity, professional versus amateur, user groups, cultural backgrounds, history of products, and the legal situation. And in the second part, I described a few methods of analysis that you can do, like task analysis, expert analysis, heuristic evaluations, benchmarking, focus groups, and all these that I mentioned. That's it for today. Thank you for spending time with me. I hope you were able to take something with you and do something for yourself that will be forever. For an ongoing exchange, you will find me on LinkedIn and on my websites, peter-rusker.com and beyond-hmi.de. Write me an email on the podcast at beyond-hmi.de. Tune in next time, take care, and stay healthy.